Part 2. The Advance of Surveillance Capitalism. Chapter 7. The Reality Business. Falling in love with truth before he knew her, he rode into imaginary lands, by solitude and fasting hoped to woo her, and mocked at those who served her with their hands. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 6. 1. The Prediction Imperative. There could not have been a more fitting setting for Eric Schmidt to share his opinion on the future of the web than the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. In 2015, during a session at the Winter Playground for neoliberals and increasingly surveillance capitalists, Schmidt was asked for his thoughts about the future of the Internet. Sitting alongside his former Google colleagues Sheryl Sandberg and Marissa Mayer, he did not hesitate to share his belief that the Internet will disappear. There will be so many IP addresses, so many devices, sensors, things that you are wearing, things that you are interacting with, that you won't even sense it. It will be part of your presence all the time. Imagine you walk into a room and the room is dynamic. The audience gasped in astonishment, and shortly thereafter, headlines around the world exploded in shock at the former Google CEO's pronouncement that the end of the Internet was at hand. Schmidt was, in fact, merely paraphrasing computer scientist Mark Weiser's seminal 1991 article, The Computer for the 21st Century, which has framed Silicon Valley's technology objectives for nearly three decades. Weiser introduced what he called ubiquitous computing with two legendary sentences. The most profound technologies are those that disappear. They weave themselves into the fabric of everyday life until they are indistinguishable from it. He described a new way of thinking that allows the computers themselves to vanish into the background, machines that fit the human environment instead of forcing humans to enter theirs will make using a computer as refreshing as taking a walk in the woods. Weiser understood that the virtual world could never be more than a shadow land, no matter how much data it absorbs. Virtual reality is only a map, not a territory. It excludes desks, offices, other people, weather, trees, walks, chance encounters, and, in general, the infinite richness of the universe. He wrote that virtual reality simulates the world rather than invisibly enhancing the world that already exists. In contrast, ubiquitous computing would infuse that real world with a universally networked apparatus of silent, calm, and voracious computing. Weiser refers to this apparatus as the new computing environment and delights in the possibilities of its limitless knowledge, such as knowing the suit you looked at for a long time last week, because it knows both of your locations, and it can retroactively find the designer's name, even though that information did not interest you at the time. Schmidt was not describing the end of the Internet, but rather its successful unshackling from dedicated devices such as the personal computer and the smartphone. For surveillance capitalists, this transition is not a choice. Surveillance profits awakened intense competition over the revenues that flow from new markets for future behavior. Even the most sophisticated process of converting behavioral surplus into products that accurately forecast the future is only as good as the raw material available for processing. Surveillance capitalists, therefore, must ask this: what forms of surplus enable the fabrication of prediction products that most reliably foretell the future? This question marks a critical turning point in the trial-and-error elaboration of surveillance capitalism. It crystallizes a second economic imperative, the prediction imperative, and reveals the intense pressure that it exerts on surveillance capitalist revenues. The first wave of prediction products enabled targeted online advertising. These products depended upon surplus derived at scale from the Internet. I have summarized the competitive forces that drive the need for surplus at scale as the extraction imperative. Competition for surveillance revenues eventually reached a point at which the volume of surplus became a necessary but insufficient condition for success. The next threshold was defined by the quality of prediction products. In the race for higher degrees of certainty, it became clear that the best predictions would have to approximate observation. The prediction imperative is the expression of these competitive forces. Google Alphabet, Facebook, Microsoft, and many more companies now drawn to surveillance revenues have staked their claims on the Internet's disappearance because they must. Compelled to improve predictions, surveillance capitalists such as Google understood that they had to widen and diversify their extraction architectures to accommodate new sources of surplus and new supply operations. Economies of scale would still be vital, of course, but in this new phase, supply operations were enlarged and intensified to accommodate economies of scope and economies of action. What does this entail? The shift toward economies of scope defines a new set of aims. Behavioral surplus must be vast, but it must also be varied. These variations are developed along two dimensions. The first is the extension of extraction operations from the virtual world into the real world, where we actually live our actual lives. Surveillance capitalists understood that their future wealth would depend upon new supply routes that extend to real life on the roads, among the trees, throughout the cities. Extension wants your bloodstream and your bed, your breakfast conversation, your commute, your run, your refrigerator, your parking space, your living room. Economies of scope also proceed along a second dimension, depth. The drive for economies of scope in the depth dimension is even more audacious. The idea here is that highly predictive, and therefore highly lucrative, behavioral surplus would be plumbed from the intimate patterns of the self. These supply operations are aimed at your personality, moods, and emotions, your lies and vulnerabilities. Every level of intimacy would have to be automatically captured and flattened into a tidal flow of data points for the factory conveyor belts that proceed toward manufactured certainty. Just as scale became necessary but insufficient for higher quality predictions, it was also clear that economies of scope would be necessary but insufficient for the highest quality of prediction products able to sustain competitive advantage in the new markets for future behavior. Behavioral surplus must be vast and varied, but the surest way to predict behavior is to intervene at its source and shape it. The processes invented to achieve this goal are what I call economies of action. In order to achieve these economies, machine processes are configured to intervene in a state of play in the real world among real people and things. These interventions are designed to enhance certainty by doing things. They nudge, tune, herd, manipulate, and modify behavior in specific directions by executing actions as subtle as inserting a specific phrase into your Facebook newsfeed, timing the appearance of a buy button on your phone, or shutting down your car engine when an insurance payment is late. This new level of competitive intensity, characterized by scope and action, ratchets up the invasive character of supply operations and initiates a new era of surveillance commerce that I call the reality business. Economies of scale were implemented by machine-based extraction architectures in the online world. Now the reality business requires machine-based architectures in the real world. These finally fulfill Weiser's vision of ubiquitous automated computational processes that weave themselves into the fabric of everyday life until they are indistinguishable from it, but with a twist. Now they operate in the interests of surveillance capitalists. There are many buzzwords that gloss over these operations and their economic origins. Ambient computing, ubiquitous computing, and the Internet of Things are but a few examples. For now, I will refer to this whole complex more generally as the apparatus. Although the labels differ, they share a consistent vision. The everywhere, always on instrumentation, datafication, connection, communication, and computation of all things, animate and inanimate, and all processes, natural, human, psychological, chemical, machine, administrative, vehicular, financial. Real-world activity is continuously rendered from phones, cars, streets, homes, shops, bodies, trees, buildings, airports, and cities back to the digital realm, where it finds new life as data ready for transformation into predictions, all of it filling the ever-expanding pages of the shadow text. As the prediction imperative gathers force, it gradually becomes clear that extraction was the first phase of a far more ambitious project. Economies of action mean that real-world machine architectures must be able to know as well as to do. Extraction is not enough. Now it must be twinned with execution. The extraction architecture is combined with a new execution architecture, through which hidden economic objectives are imposed upon the vast and varied field of behavior. Gradually, as surveillance capitalism's imperatives and the material infrastructures that perform extraction and execution operations begin to function as a coherent whole, they produce a 21st century means of behavioral modification. The aim of this undertaking is not to impose behavioral norms, such as conformity or obedience, but rather to produce behavior that reliably, definitively, and certainly leads to desired commercial results. The research director of Gartner, the well-respected business advisory and research firm, makes the point unambiguously when he observes that mastery of the Internet of Things will serve as a key enabler in the transformation of business models from guaranteed levels of performance to guaranteed outcomes. This is an extraordinary statement because there can be no such guarantees in the absence of the power to make it so. This wider complex that we refer to as the means of behavioral modification is the expression of this gathering power. The prospect of guaranteed outcomes alerts us to the force of the prediction imperative, which demands that surveillance capitalists make the future for the sake of predicting it. Under this regime, ubiquitous computing is not just a knowing machine. It is an actuating machine designed to produce more certainty about us and for them. This gradually accruing, smart, and muscular apparatus is gradually being assembled around us. No one knows what the real magnitude is or will be. It is a domain plagued by hyperbole, where projections frequently outrun actual results. Despite this, the planning, investment, and invention necessary to draw this vision of ubiquity into reality are well underway. The visions and aims of its architects, the work that has already been accomplished, and the programs that are currently in development constitute a turning point in the evolution of surveillance capitalism. Finally, I want to underscore that although it may be possible to imagine something like the Internet of Things without surveillance capitalism, it is impossible to imagine surveillance capitalism without something like the Internet of Things. Every command arising from the prediction imperative requires this pervasive, real-world, material, knowing, and doing presence. The new apparatus is the material expression of the prediction imperative, and it represents a new kind of power animated by the economic compulsion toward certainty. Two vectors converge in this fact: the early ideals of ubiquitous computing and the economic imperatives of surveillance capitalism. This convergence signals the metamorphosis of the digital infrastructure from a thing that we have to a thing that has us. Futuristic as this may sound, the vision of individuals and groups as so many objects to be continuously tracked, wholly known, and shunted this way or that for some purpose of which they are unaware has a history. It was coaxed to life nearly 60 years ago under the warm equatorial sun of the Galapagos Islands when a giant tortoise stirred from her torpor to swallow a succulent chunk of cactus into which a dedicated scientist had wedged a small machine. It was a time when scientists reckoned with the obstinacy of free-roaming animals and concluded that surveillance was the necessary price of knowledge. Locking these creatures in a zoo would only eliminate the very behavior that scientists wanted to study, but how were they to be surveilled? The solutions once concocted by scholars of elk herds, sea turtles, and geese have been refurbished by surveillance capitalists and presented as an inevitable feature of 21st century life on Earth. All that has changed is that now we are the animals. 2. The Tender Conquest of Unrestrained Animals. It was a 1964 international expedition to the Galapagos Islands that presented a unique opportunity to explore telemetry, a frontier technology based on the long-distance transmission of computer data. A new breed of scientists who combined biology, physics, engineering, and electronics championed this new tech. And chief among these was R. Stuart MacKay, a physicist come electrical engineer, biologist, and surgeon, who was known among his scientific peers as the expert's expert. MacKay viewed telemetry as a means of enhancing and protecting the well-being of animal populations. A photo of MacKay from the Galapagos expedition shows him poised tenderly beside a giant tortoise that had swallowed his tiny machine. In another, he gently holds a rare marine iguana with a sensor attached to its torso, all of it to measure the animal's internal body temperatures. He emphasized the key element that distinguished telemetry from other forms of monitoring: the possibility of capturing behavior in its natural habitat with sensors of such compactness that they could disappear into the body without triggering the animal's awareness. The use of a radio signal from a transmitter, in or on a subject, to carry information to a remote receiver for recording allows flexibility of movement and permits disturbance-free exploration of otherwise inaccessible parts of the body without the subject even being aware of the measuring process. The methods leave the subject in a relatively normal psychological and physiological state and do not interfere with the continuation of normal activities. MacKay's published work focused primarily on the technical aspects of his studies, although occasionally there is a glimpse of larger purpose. Telemetry created the possibility of huge data sets and the opportunity for correlational studies at the scale of entire animal populations. He noted that the same techniques could be applied to the static world: forest canopies, the curing of concrete, chemical reaction vessels, and food processing. MacKay envisioned whole populations of connected data-emitting individuals. His first-generation wearable technologies made it possible to study unrestrained animals among every species, including people. Biomedical telemetry, he stressed, was uniquely suited to gather information that would be otherwise impossible to collect in the wild. The key principle was that his telematics operated outside an animal's awareness. This was especially useful in solving problems such as the difficulty of measuring uncooperative animals and the need to gather data even when herds roamed through inaccessible regions. In other words, MacKay's inventions enabled scientists to render animals as information, even when they believed themselves to be free, wandering and resting, unaware of the incursion into their once mysterious landscapes. MacKay stressed that the transmission and monitoring of sensor data were only part of the story. The route was not enough. It had to be the routing. He argued for a reverse process of telestimulation that would not only monitor behavior, but also reveal how it could be modified and optimized, providing what he regarded as a remote dialogue between the subject and the experimenter. MacKay's broad vision has come to fruition in the digital age. Satellite acuity, combined with the explosive growth of computational power fitted onto tiny slivers of silicon, advanced sensors, Internet-enabled networks and big data predictive analytics have produced extraordinary systems that reveal the meanings and movements of whole animal populations and their individuals, anywhere, anytime. The same wearables traveling on and in the bodies of animals have also become broad sensors of the planet's climate, geography, and ecology, enabling a quorum sensing of our planet, using a variety of species to tap into the diversity of senses that have evolved across animal groups, producing a sixth sense of the global animal collective. As you will already have guessed, there is little reason to suppose that these capabilities will remain trained on non-human species. Indeed, the threshold has already been crossed. In 2014, a team of University of Washington researchers, led by Zheneng Huang, announced a super GPS assembled from municipal surveillance cameras to enable the dynamic visualization of the realistic situation of humans walking on the road and sidewalks. So eventually, people can see the animated version of the real-time dynamics of city streets on a platform like Google Earth. If this were a novel, then Professor McKay's brilliant work, along with that of the many dedicated scientists who followed in his footsteps, would serve as foreshadowing. In a metamorphosis that McKay did not foresee, the science of animal tracking that grew from his path-breaking vision became the template for surveillance capitalism's next phase of evolution, as telematics, now applied to human behavior, succumbed to the thrall of a new and lucrative logic of accumulation. The requirements of prediction that would later merge into an economic imperative were already evident in McKay's work. The need for economies of scope, both in extension and depth, is reflected in his foundational framework that aimed to render information about populations and the details of individuals, reaching into the distant corners of previously inaccessible regions. Today, those regions include the front seat of your car, your kitchen, and your kidneys. His reverse process of telestimulation is resurrected in the economies of action that automatically stimulate behavior, not to save the human herd from catastrophe, but rather to heighten the predictability of its behavior. McKay yearned for discovery, but today's experimenters yearn for certainty as they translate our lives into calculations. McKay's animals were unrestrained and innately uncooperative because they felt themselves to be free, sheltering and roaming in unknown terrain. Now, the unself-conscious, easy freedom enjoyed by the human animal, the sense of being unrestrained that thrives in the mystery of distant places and intimate spaces, is simply friction on the path toward surveillance revenues. 3. Human herds. McKay's legacy is reimagined for our time in the work of Professor Joseph Paradiso of the MIT Media Lab, where some of surveillance capitalism's most valuable capabilities and applications, from data mining to wearable technologies, were invented. Paradiso's brilliant group of data scientists, engineers, musicians, and artists reconceives the world through the lens of Google search by applying the same disciplines that mastered the web, datafication, indexing, browsing, and searching, to master reality itself. Without ubiquitous sensate environments, Paradiso writes, the cognitive engines of this everywhere-enabled world are deaf, dumb, and blind, and can't respond relevantly to the real-world events that they aim to augment. In other words, ubiquitous computing is meaningless without the ubiquitous sensing that conveys the experience for computation. To this end, Paradiso's students invented a listen tree, which emits streaming sound that invites attention and points to a future where digital information might become a seamless part of the physical world. He and his colleagues populated a 250-acre marsh with hundreds of sensors that measure and record temperature, humidity, moisture, light motion, wind, sound, tree sap flow, chemical levels, and more. They developed inertial sensors that track and compute complex movements and flexible sensate fibers to create radically new functional substrates that can impact medicine, fashion, and apparel, and bring electronics into all things stretchable or malleable. There are electronics that attach directly to skin in the form of tattoos and makeup, while fingernails and wrists are transformed into computational interfaces that can read finger gestures, even in the absence of hand movements. Sensor tape and stickers can adhere to inaccessible surfaces and building materials, where they can be wirelessly interrogated. Paradiso and his colleagues wrestled with the paradox of, on the one hand, proliferating sensor data in nearly every environment, from smartphones to home devices to streets to cameras to cars, and, on the other hand, the difficulties involved in integrating sensor-generated data flows and producing meaningful analyses. Their answer was DoppelLab, a digital platform for combining and visually representing sensor data. The idea is to transform any physical space, from the interior of an office building to an entire city, into a browsable environment where you can see and hear everything going on in that space as it flows from thousands or billions or trillions of sensors. Just as browsers like Netscape first gave us access to the mass of data contained on the internet, so will software browsers enable us to make sense of the flood of sensor data that is on the way. The aim here is a grand synthesis, the collation and fusion of every sort of sensor data from every channel and device to develop a virtual sensor environment in which crawlers will constantly traverse data, calculating state and estimating other parameters derived from the data, collected from everywhere from office interiors to entire cities. Paradiso is confident that a proper interface to this artificial sensoria promises to produce a digital omniscience, a pervasive everywhere augmented reality environment that can be intuitively browsed, just as web browsers opened up the data contained on the internet. He insists that ubiquitous sensor information and computing will be an extension of ourselves rather than an embodiment of an other. Information will stream directly into our eyes and ears once we enter the age of wearables. The boundaries of the individual will be very blurry in this future. According to Paradiso and his co-author Gershon Dublon, the next great technological challenge is context aggregation, which means the ability to assemble rapidly expanding sensor information into new applications. The idea is that every physical space and every trace of behavior within that space, bees buzzing, your smile, the temperature fluctuations in my closet, their breakfast conversation, the swoosh of the trees, will be informated, translated into information. Spaces can be aggregated into a seamless flow of searchable information, sights, and sounds in much the same way that Google once aggregated web pages for indexing and searching. This shift will create a seamless nervous system that covers the planet, and one of the main challenges for the computing community now is how to merge the rapidly evolving omniscient electronic sensoria onto human perception. For all their brilliance, these creative scientists appear to be unaware of the restless economic order eager to commandeer their achievements under the flag of surveillance revenues. Paradiso does not reckon with the translation of his paradise of omniscience into the realpolitik of surveillance capitalism, as the prediction imperative insists on surplus culled from these new flows, and surveillance capitalists fill the front seats of the classroom of digital omniscience. 4. Surveillance capitalism's realpolitik. Waning levels of government leadership and funding for ubiquitous computing leave the technology companies to lead in basic research and applications, each vying to become the Google of the new apparatus and its architectures of extraction and execution. Despite the radical prospects of the ubiquitous connected sensate computational apparatus, and the often repeated claim it will change everything, technology firms in the U.S. have, thus far, continued their run of relative lawlessness, unimpeded by any comprehensive social or regulatory vision. As Intel's chief strategist for the Internet of Things commented in response to concerns over privacy implications, "One thing that we absolutely believe is that though we hear the conversation around policy, we don't want policy to get in the way of technological innovation. In place of policy, or a social contract, it is capitalism, an increasingly surveillance capitalism, that shapes the action. New behavioral futures markets and targeted applications are eagerly awaited. As Microsoft's director of the machine intelligence platform for integrating and analyzing data from the Internet of Things says, the part that's equally cool and creepy is what happens after everybody and their competitor gets on board with smart devices. A big secondary market for data, a secondary revenue source. These markets, he explains, are just like Google or Facebook's markets for targeted advertising. An IBM report concurs. Thanks to the Internet of Things, physical assets are turning into participants in real-time global digital markets. The countless types of assets around us will become as easily indexed, searched, and traded as any online commodity. We call this the liquefaction of the physical world." In an ominous parallel to the rhetoric of data exhaust as the prelude to dispossession, this second phase of expropriation also requires new rhetoric that can simultaneously legitimate and distract from the real action unleashed by the predictive imperative. A new euphemism, dark data, plays this role. For example, Harriet Green directed IBM's $3 billion investment in the Internet of Things, a resource commitment that aimed to make the company a serious contender to become the Google of ubiquitous computing. Green says that digital omniscience is impeded by the fact that most of the data collected by companies are unstructured, making them difficult to datafy and code. IBM's customers are plagued by the question, what can we do with this unstructured data to make us more efficient, or to create new products and services that we can sell to optimize what we're doing or create new things for clients? Unstructured data cannot merge and flow in the new circuits of liquefied assets bought and sold. They are friction. Green fixes on the declarative term that simultaneously names the problem and justifies its solution. Dark data. The message we saw honed in the online world, if you're not in the system, you don't exist, is refined for this new phase of dispossession. Because the apparatus of connected things is intended to be everything, any behavior of human or thing absent from this push for universal inclusion is dark, menacing, untamed, rebellious, rogue, out of control. The stubborn expanse of dark data is framed as the enemy of IBM's and its customers' ambitions. Note the echoes of McKay here, with his determination to penetrate the secrets of unrestrained animals and inaccessible regions. The tension is that no thing counts until it is rendered as behavior, translated into electronic data flows, and channeled into the light as observable data. Everything must be illuminated for counting and herding. In this way, the notion of dark data handily becomes the data exhaust of ubiquitous computing. It provides the moral, technical, commercial, and legal rationale for powerful systems of machine intelligence that can capture and analyze behaviors and conditions never intended for a public life. For those who seek surveillance revenues, dark data represent lucrative and necessary territories in the dynamic universal jigsaw constituted by surveillance capitalism's urge towards scale, scope, and action. Thus, the technology community casts dark data as the intolerable unknown unknown that threatens the financial promise of the Internet of Things. It is therefore understandable that Green portrays machine intelligence, and specifically IBM's anthropomorphized artificial intelligence system called Watson, as the authoritative savior of an apparatus threatened by waste and incomprehensibility. Machine intelligence is referred to as cognitive computing at IBM, presumably to avoid the uneasy connotations of inscrutable power associated with words like machine and artificial. Under the leadership of CEO Ginni Rometty, the corporation invested heavily in Watson, heralded by the company as the brains of the Internet of Things. Rometty wants IBM to dominate the machine learning functions that will translate ubiquitous data into ubiquitous knowledge and action. The first discussion is around how much dark data you have that only Watson and Cognitive can really interrogate, Green says. You know the amount of data being created on a daily basis, much of which will go to waste unless it is utilized. This so-called dark data represents a phenomenal opportunity, the ability to use sensors for everything in the world to basically be a computer, whether it's your contact lens, your hospital bed, or a railway track. The message is that surveillance capitalism's new instruments will render the entire world's actions and conditions as behavioral flows. Each rendered bit is liberated from its life in the social, no longer inconveniently encumbered by moral reasoning, politics, social norms, rights, values, relationships, feelings, contexts, and situations. In the flatness of this flow, data are data, and behavior is behavior. The body is simply a set of coordinates in time and space where sensation and action are translated as data. All things, animate and inanimate, share the same existential status in this blended confection, each reborn as an objective and measurable, indexable, browsable, searchable it. From the vantage point of surveillance capitalism and its economic imperatives, world, self, and body are reduced to the permanent status of objects as they disappear into the bloodstream of a titanic new conception of markets. His washing machine, her car's accelerator, and your intestinal flora are collapsed into a single dimension of equivalency as information assets that can be disaggregated, reconstituted, indexed, browsed, manipulated, analyzed, reaggregated, predicted, productized, bought and sold, anywhere, anytime. The worldview elaborated by scientists such as Paradiso and business leaders such as Green has been swept into action on many fronts where digital omniscience is eagerly welcomed as the recipe for certainty in the service of certain profits. The next section is an opportunity to see this worldview in action. In a business sector far from the pioneers of surveillance capitalism, automobile insurance. Extraction and prediction become the hallmarks of a new logic of accumulation as insurers and their consultants plot their approach to surveillance revenues. In the plans and practices of these new actors, we witness both the determination to institutionalize economies of scope and action, and the drift toward a dark new world in which the automatic and closely targeted means of behavioral modification are understood as the path to profit. 5. Certainty for profit. In Chapter 3, we met Google's Hal Varian, and now once again he lights the way, exposing the significance and specific requirements of the prediction imperative. Recall that Varian identified 4 new uses of the computer mediation of transactions. The first of these was data extraction and analysis, from which we deduced the extraction imperative as one of the foundational mechanisms of surveillance capitalism. Varian says that the other 3 new uses, new contractual forms due to better monitoring, personalization and customization, and continuous experiments, will in time become even more important than the first. That time has come. Because transactions are now computer-mediated, we can observe behavior that was previously unobservable and write contracts on it, Varian says. This enables transactions that were simply not feasible before. He gravitates to the example of vehicular monitoring systems, recognizing their paradigmatic power. Varian says that if someone stops making monthly car payments, nowadays it's a lot easier just to instruct the vehicular monitoring system not to allow the car to be started and to signal the location where it can be picked up. Insurance companies, he notes, can also rely on these monitoring systems to check if customers are driving safely, and thus determine whether to maintain the insurance policy, vary the cost of premiums, and decide whether to pay a claim. Varian's new uses of computer mediation in this insurance realm are entirely dependent upon internet-enabled devices that know and do. In fact, they are impossible to imagine without the material means of extraction and execution architectures planted in and permeating the real world. The vehicular monitoring system that he prescribes, for example, provides economies of scope and action. It knows and intervenes in the state of play, monitoring data and acting on programmed instructions to shut off the car's engine, thus allowing the repo man to locate the disabled automobile and its vanquished driver. As the prediction imperative pulls supply operations into the real world, product or service providers in established sectors far from Silicon Valley are enthralled by the prospects of surveillance revenues. For example, the CEO of Allstate Insurance wants to be like Google. There are lots of people who are monetizing data today. You get on Google and it seems like it's free. It's not free. You're giving them information, they sell your information. Could we, should we sell this information we get from people driving around to various people and capture some additional profit source? It's a long-term game. Automobile insurers appear to be especially eager to implement Varian's vision and McKay's telematics. The fight for your car, it turns out, is an illustration of the intensity of purpose with which companies, great and small, now pursue behavioral surplus. Auto insurers have long known that risk is highly correlated with driver behavior and personality, but there was little that they could do about it. Now, the remote sensate monitoring systems of modern telematics can provide a continuous stream of data about where we are, where we're going, the details of our driving behavior, and the conditions of our vehicle. App-based telematics can also calculate how we are feeling and what we are saying by integrating dashboard and even smartphone information. Auto insurers are besieged by consultants and would-be technology partners who proffer surveillance capitalistic strategies that promise a new chapter of commercial success. Uncertainty will be strongly reduced, intones a McKinsey report on the future of the insurance industry. This leads to demutualization and a focus on predicting and managing individual risks rather than communities. A report by Deloitte's Center for Financial Services counsels risk minimization, a euphemism for guaranteed outcomes, through monitoring and enforcing policyholder behavior in real time, an approach called behavioral underwriting. Insurers can monitor policyholder behavior directly, Deloitte advises, by recording the times, locations, and road conditions when they drive, whether they rapidly accelerate or drive at high or even excessive speeds, how hard they brake, as well as how rapidly they make turns and whether they use their turn signals. Telematics produce continuous data flows, so real-time behavioral surplus can replace the traditional proxy factors, such as demographic information, that had previously been used to calculate risk. This means that surplus must both be plentiful, economies of scale, and varied, economies of scope, in both range and depth. Even smaller underwriters that cannot afford extensive capital outlays for telematics are advised that they can accomplish most of these aims with a smartphone application, eliminating costly hardware and data transmission expenses. These insurers may also benefit because a mobile app gathers first-hand data on the behavior and performance of the driver carrying the smartphone, yielding a 360-degree view of the total exposure being underwritten. As certainty replaces uncertainty, premiums that once reflected the necessary unknowns of everyday life can now rise and fall from millisecond to millisecond, informed by the precise knowledge of how fast you drive to work after an unexpectedly hectic early morning caring for a sick child, or if you perform wheelies in the parking lot behind the supermarket. We know that 16-year-old drivers have a whole lot of accidents, but not every 16-year-old is a lousy driver, observes one insurance industry telematics expert. Rates based on actual behavior are a big advantage in being able to price appropriately. This kind of certainty means that insurance contracts designed to mitigate risk now give way to machine processes that respond almost immediately to nuanced infractions of prescribed behavioral parameters and thus substantially decrease risk or eliminate it entirely. Telematics are not intended merely to know, but also to do, economies of action. They are hammers. They are muscular. They enforce. Behavioral underwriting promises to reduce risk through machine processes designed to modify behavior in the direction of maximum profitability. Behavioral surplus is used to trigger punishments, such as real-time rate hikes, financial penalties, curfews, and engine lockdowns, or rewards, such as rate discounts, coupons, and gold stars to redeem for future benefits. The consultancy firm A.T. Kearney anticipates IoT-enriched relationships to connect more holistically with customers to influence their behaviors. Varian's blithe statement that it's a lot easier to instruct a vehicular monitoring system to shut off a car when a payment is late is not hyperbole. For example, Spirion, which describes itself as the largest aftermarket vehicle telematics company and specializes in tracking and monitoring vehicles and drivers for a variety of customers such as lenders, insurers, and fleet owners, offers a system akin to Varian's ideal. Its loan plus collateral management system pushes alerts to drivers when they have fallen behind in their payments, remotely disables the vehicle when delinquency exceeds a predetermined period, and locates the vehicle for the repo man to recover. Telematics announce a new day of behavioral control. Now the insurance company can set specific parameters for driving behavior. These can include anything from fastening the seatbelt to rate of speed, idling times, braking and cornering, aggressive acceleration, harsh braking, excessive hours on the road, driving out of state, and entering a restricted area. These parameters are translated into algorithms that continuously monitor, evaluate, and rank the driver, calculations that translate into real-time rate adjustments. According to a patent held by Spirion's top strategist, insurers can eliminate uncertainty by shaping behavior. The idea is to continuously optimize the insurance rate based on monitoring the driver's adherence to behavioral parameters defined by the insurer. The system translates its behavioral knowledge into power, assigning credits or imposing punishments on drivers. Surplus is also translated into prediction products for sale to advertisers. The system calculates behavioral traits for advertisers to target, sending ads directly to the driver's phone. A second patent is even more explicit about triggers for punitive measures. It identifies a range of algorithms that activate consequences when the system's parameters are breached. A violation algorithm, a curfew algorithm, a monitoring algorithm, an adherence algorithm, a credit algorithm. The consultancy firms are aligned in advising all their insurance clients to get into the surveillance game. A.T. Kearney acknowledges that the connected car is a proving ground for what is to come. Ultimately, IoT's true value depends on customers adjusting their behaviors and risk profiles based on feedback from their things. Health insurers are another target. Wearable accelerometers could improve traceability of their compliance with prescribed exercise regimes, and digestible sensors could track compliance with dietary and medication schedules, providing higher truth and better granularity than a monthly refill. Deloitte acknowledges that, according to its own survey data, most consumers reject telematics on the basis of privacy concerns and mistrust companies that want to monitor their behavior. This reluctance can be overcome, the consultants advise, by offering cost savings significant enough that people are willing to make the privacy trade-off, in spite of lingering concerns. If price inducements don't work, insurers are counseled to present behavioral monitoring as fun, interactive, competitive, and gratifying, rewarding drivers for improvements on their past record and relative to the broader policyholder pool. In this approach, known as gamification, drivers can be engaged to participate in performance-based contests and incentive-based challenges. If all else fails, insurers are advised to induce a sense of inevitability and helplessness in their customers. Deloitte counsels companies to emphasize the multitude of other technologies already in play to monitor driving, and that enhanced surveillance and/or geolocation capabilities are part of the world we live in now, for better or worse. Behavioral underwriting offers auto insurers cost savings and efficiencies, but it is not the end game for a revitalized insurance industry. The analytics that produced targeted advertising in the online world are repurposed for the real world, laying the foundation for new behavioral futures markets that trade in the predictions of customer behavior. This is where the real drive for surveillance revenues is focused. For example, an executive of cloud services provider Covisint advises clients aiming to cash in on automotive telematics to move beyond targeted ads to targeted applications. These are not ads on a screen, but real-life experiences shaped by the same capabilities as targeted ads and designed to lure you into real places for the sake of others' profit. That means selling driver data to third parties that will figure out where you are, where you're going, and what you want. They know what restaurants you like because you drive your car there, so they can recommend restaurants as you're driving, and the restaurants will pay. Behavioral surplus is understood as the raw material for products that establish co-marketing with other services, such as towing, auto repair, car washes, restaurants, retail outlets. The consultants at McKinsey make a similar recommendation, advising insurers that the Internet of Things enables their expansion into completely new areas, such as data marketplaces. Health surplus can be monetized, says Deloitte, by providing relevant referrals. The firm advises its clients, especially those unlikely to reach scale in telematics, to establish partnerships with digital players. The model is a 2016 deal between IBM and General Motors that announced the creation of OnStar Go, the car industry's first cognitive mobility platform. Dell and Microsoft have launched Internet of Things insurance accelerators. Dell provides insurers with hardware, software, analytics, and services to more accurately predict risk and take preventative measures. And Microsoft has linked up with American Family Insurance to develop startups focused on home automation. The data companies were once regarded as mere suppliers, but it is more likely that the auto companies will become suppliers to the data behemoths. Google tries to accompany people throughout their day, to generate data and then use that data for economic gain, acknowledges Daimler's CEO. It's at that point where a conflict with Google seems pre-programmed. Google and Amazon are already locked in competition for the dashboard of your car, where their systems will control all communication and applications. From there, it is a short step to telemetry and related data. Google already offers applications developers a cloud-based, scalable geolocation telemetry system using Google Maps. In 2016, Google France announced its interest in partnerships with insurance companies to develop bundles of products which blend technology and hardware with insurance. That same year, a report from Capgemini Consultants found that 40% of insurers see Google as a potential rival and threat because of its strong brand and ability to manage customer data. 6. Executing the uncontract. These examples, drawn from the ordinary world of automobile insurance, teach some extraordinary lessons. Drivers are persuaded, induced, incentivized, or coerced into a quid pro quo that links pricing to the expansion of a real-world extraction execution architecture aimed at new behavioral surplus flows, economies of scope. Behavioral data drawn from their experience are processed, and the results flow in two directions. First, they return to the drivers, executing procedures to interrupt and shape behavior in order to enhance the certainty and therefore profitability of predictions, economies of action. Second, prediction products that rank and sort driver behavior flow into newly convened behavioral futures markets, in which third parties lay bets on what drivers will do now, soon, and later. Will he maintain a high safety rating? Will she act in compliance with our rules? Will he drive like a girl? These bets translate into pricing, incentive structures, and monitoring and compliance regimes. In both operations, surplus drawn from the driver's experience is repurposed as the means to shape and compel the driver's experience for the sake of guaranteed outcomes. Most of this occurs, as McKay advised, outside the driver's awareness, while she still thinks that she is free. The Google declarations underwrite all the action here. As Varian writes, "Because transactions are now computer-mediated, we can observe behavior that was previously unobservable and write contracts on it. This enables transactions that were simply not feasible before." Varian's "we" refers to those with privileged access to the shadow text into which behavioral data flow. Our behavior, once unobservable, is declared as free for the taking, theirs to own, and theirs to decide how to use and how to profit from. This includes the production of new contractual forms that compel us in ways that would not have been possible but for surveillance capitalism's original declarations of dispossession. Varian recognized that the subregions of automotive telematics exemplify this new economic frontier when he wrote, "Nowadays, it's a lot easier just to instruct the vehicular monitoring system not to allow the car to be started and to signal the location where it can be picked up." Yawn. But wait, a lot easier for whom? He means, of course, a lot easier for the "we" that now observes what was, until surveillance capitalism, unobservable, and executes actions that were, until surveillance capitalism, not feasible. Varian's laid-back, simple prose is a kind of lullaby that makes his observations seem banal, so ordinary as to barely warrant comment. But in Varian's scenario, what happens to the driver? What if there is a child in the car, or a blizzard, or a train to catch, or a daycare center drop-off on the way to work? A mother on life support in the hospital still miles away, a son waiting to be picked up at school. It was not long ago that Varian's prosaic proclamations were regarded as the stuff of nightmares. In his 1967 book, The Year 2000, the hyper-rational wunderkind futurist Herman Kahn anticipated many of the capabilities that Varian now assigns to the new extraction execution architecture. Kahn was no shrinking violet, He was rumored to be director Stanley Kubrick's model for the title character in Dr. Strangelove, and he was well known for arguing that nuclear war is both winnable and survivable. Yet it was Kahn who foresaw innovations such as Varian's vehicular monitoring system and characterized them as a 21st century nightmare. Among his many technology-oriented insights, Kahn foresaw automated computer systems that track all vehicular movements and also listen to and record conversations with all the capability available for high-speed scan and search. He imagined computer systems able to detect and respond to individual behavior, a raised voice, a threatening tone. Such computers may also be able to apply a great deal of inferential logic on their own. They may become a sort of transitorized Sherlock Holmes, making hypotheses and investigating leads in a more or less autonomous or self-motivated manner. Anyone who wields this kind of knowledge, he concluded, is, like Faust, less immoral than amoral, indifferent to the fate of those who stand in his way, rather than brutal. Contemporary reviewers of Kahn's book invariably seized upon the dark nightmare scenarios of the computerized surveillance theme, the science fiction-like forms of control that, they assumed, will be actively feared and resented by many. Despite the wide range of scenarios that Kahn presented in his book on the distant year 2000, Kahn's voyage into the unthinkable was viewed by the public as a way to prepare for the worst possible outcome in a terrifying nightmare of social controls. Yet now, that same nightmare is rendered as an enthusiastic progress report on surveillance capitalism's latest triumphs. Varian's update is delivered without self-consciousness or a hint of controversy, rather than the astonishment and revulsion that were predicted just decades ago. How has the nightmare become banal? Where is our sense of astonishment and outrage? Political scientist Langdon Winner grappled with this question in his seminal book Autonomous Technology, published in 1977. His answer? "What we lack is our bearings," he wrote. Winner painstakingly described the ways in which our experience of things technological confounds our vision, our expectations, and our capacity to make intelligent judgments. Categories, arguments, conclusions, and choices that would have been entirely obvious in earlier times are obvious no longer. So let us establish our bearings. What Varian celebrates here is not a new form of contract, but rather a final solution to the enduring uncertainty that is the raison d'etre of contract as a means of private ordering. In fact, the use of the word contract in Varian's formulation is a perfect example of the horseless carriage syndrome. Varian's invention is unprecedented and cannot be understood as simply another kind of contract. It is, in fact, the annihilation of contract. This invention is better understood as the uncontract. The uncontract is a feature of the larger complex that is the means of behavioral modification, and it is therefore an essential modality of surveillance capitalism. It contributes to economies of action by leveraging proprietary behavioral surplus to preempt and foreclose action alternatives, thus replacing the interdeterminacy of social processes with the determinism of programmed machine processes. This is not the automation of society, as some might think, but rather the replacement of society with machine action dictated by economic imperatives. The uncontract is not a space of contractual relations, but rather a unilateral execution that makes those relations unnecessary. The uncontract desocializes the contract, manufacturing certainty through the substitution of automated procedures for promises, dialogue, shared meaning, problem-solving, dispute resolution, and trust. The expressions of solidarity and human agency that have been gradually institutionalized in the notion of contract over the course of millennia. The uncontract bypasses all that social work in favor of compulsion, and it does so for the sake of more lucrative prediction products that approximate observation and therefore guarantee outcomes. This substitution of machine work for social work is possible thanks to the success of Google's declarations and the road that Google paved for surveillance capitalists' dominance of the division of learning. Sitting in the catbird seat, Google can observe what was previously unobservable and know what was previously unknowable. As a result, the company can do what was previously undoable, bypass social relations in favor of automated machine processes that compel the behaviors that advance commercial objectives. When we celebrate the uncontract, as Varian and others do, we celebrate the asymmetries of knowledge and power that produce these new possibilities. The uncontract is a signpost that reminds us of our bearings as we follow the next sections of this chapter toward a clearer picture of surveillance capitalism's growing ambitions in the annexation of reality to its kingdom of conquered human experience. 7. Inevitabilism. It is difficult to keep your bearings when everyone around you is losing theirs. The transition to ubiquitous computing, when sensors are everywhere, Paradiso writes, won't be incremental, but rather a revolutionary phase shift, much like the arrival of the World Wide Web. The same phase shift that is understood by its architects as the universal antidote to uncertainty is anticipated with absolute certainty. Paradiso is not alone here. On the contrary, the rhetoric of inevitability is so ubiquitous that within the tech company it can be considered a full-blown ideology of inevitabilism. The sense of incontestable certainty that infuses Paradiso's vision has long been recognized as a key feature of utopianism. In their definitive history of utopian thought, Frank and Fritz Emanuel wrote that, since the end of the 18th century, the predictive utopia has become a major form of imaginative thought and has preempted certain scientific techniques of forecasting the contemporary utopia, binds past, present, and future together as though fated. The state they depict appears virtually ordained either by God or by history. There is a carryover of millenarian certainty. The Manuels, along with many other historians, consider Marxism to be the last great modern utopia. There are hundreds of passages in Karl Marx's writing that convey his inevitabilism. In the very first section of the Communist Manifesto, published in 1848, Marx wrote the following: "What the bourgeoisie, therefore, produces above all is its own grave diggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable." Before the rise of the modern utopia, the genre was largely composed of fantastical narratives in which isolated pockets of human perfection were discovered in exotic mountain areas, hidden valleys, or faraway islands. Modern utopias, such as Marxism, diverge from those fairy tales, addressing the reformation of the entire species with a rational, systemic vision whose province was the whole world. No longer content as mere weavers of dreams, modern utopianists shifted toward totalistic and universal visions, prophecies of the ineluctable end toward which mankind was moving. Now, the proselytizers of ubiquitous computing join Marx and other modern utopianists in postulating a new phase of history, like Paradiso's revolutionary phase shift, in which all of society is reassembled in a novel and superior pattern. Despite the fact that inevitability is the opposite of politics and history, apostles of the apparatus routinely hijack historical metaphors that lend a veneer of gravitas to their claims. The rise of the apparatus is alternatively cast as the inauguration of a new age, era, wave, phase, or stage. This kind of historical framing conveys the futility of opposition to the categorical inevitability of the march toward ubiquity. Silicon Valley is the axis mundi of inevitabilism. Among high-tech leaders, within the specialist literature, and among expert professionals, there appears to be universal agreement on the idea that everything will be connected, knowable, and actionable in the near future. Ubiquity and its consequences in total information are an article of faith. Not surprisingly, Google's leaders are passionate inevitabilists. The very first sentences of Schmidt and Cohen's 2013 book, The New Digital Age, exemplify this thrust. "Soon everyone on Earth will be connected," they write. So-called predictive laws, much as Moore's Law and photonics, are called upon to signal this new iron law of necessity that will produce exponential growth in connectivity and computational power. And later, the collective benefit of sharing human knowledge and creativity grows at an exponential rate. In the future, information technology will be everywhere, like electricity. It will be a given. When the book's assertions garnered some criticism, the authors confronted their critics in an afterword to the paperback edition. But bemoaning the inevitable increase in the size and reach of the technology sector distracts us from the real question. Many of the changes we discuss are inevitable. They're coming. Despite its pervasiveness both in Silicon Valley and in the wider culture of data scientists and technology developers, inevitabilism is rarely discussed or critically evaluated. Paradiso's conception of a digital omniscience is taken for granted, with little discussion of politics, power, markets, or governments. As in most accounts of the apparatus, questions of individual autonomy, moral reasoning, social norms and values, privacy, decision rights, politics, and law take the form of afterthoughts and genuflections that can be solved with the correct protocols or addressed with still more technology solutions. If information will stream directly into our eyes and ears, and the boundaries of the individual will be very blurry, then who can access that information? What if I don't want my life streaming through your senses? Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? The answers to such questions are drowned in the thrum of all things continuously illuminated, registered, counted, controlled, and judged. The best that Paradiso can offer up is a suggestion that the law could give a person ownership or control of data generated in his or her vicinity. A person could then choose to encrypt or restrict those data from entering the network. Paradiso imagines a society in which it falls to each individual to protect herself from the omniscient, ubiquitous, sensate computational systems of the new apparatus. Rather than paradise, it seems a recipe for a new breed of madness. Yet this is precisely the world that is now under construction around us, and this madness appears to be a happy feature of the plan. Between 2012 and 2015, I interviewed 52 data scientists and specialists in the Internet of Things. They came from 19 different companies with a combined 586 years of experience in high-technology corporations and startups, primarily in Silicon Valley. I spoke with them about the prominence of inevitability rhetoric among the purveyors of the new apparatus, and I posed the same question to each one. Why do so many people say that ubiquitous computing is inevitable? The agreement among their responses was striking. Although they did not have the language of surveillance capitalism, nearly every interviewee regarded inevitability rhetoric as a Trojan horse for powerful economic imperatives, and each one of them lamented the lack of any critical discussion of these assumptions. As the marketing director of a Silicon Valley firm that sells software to link smart devices told me, "There's all that dumb real estate out there, and we've got to turn it into revenue. The Internet of Things is all push, not pull. Most consumers do not feel a need for these devices. You can say exponential and inevitable as much as you want. The bottom line is that the Valley has decided that this has to be the next thing so that firms here can grow." I spoke with a senior engineer from a large tech company that invests heavily in the Internet of Things. The response: imagine you have a hammer. That's machine learning. It helped you climb a grueling mountain to reach the summit. That's machine learning's dominance of online data. On the mountaintop, you find a vast pile of nails, cheaper than anything previously imaginable. That's the new smart sensor tech. An unbroken vista of virgin board stretches before you as far as you can see. That's the whole dumb world. Then you learn that any time you plant a nail in a board with your machine learning hammer, you can extract value from that formerly dumb plank. That's data monetization. What do? You start hammering like crazy and you never stop, unless somebody makes you stop. But there is nobody up here to make us stop. This is why the Internet of Everything is inevitable. A senior systems architect laid out the imperative in the clearest terms. The IoT is inevitable, like getting to the Pacific Ocean was inevitable. It's manifest destiny. 98% of things in the world are not connected. So we're gonna connect them. It could be a moisture temperature that sits in the ground. It could be your liver. That's your IoT. The next step is what we do with the data. We'll visualize it, make sense of it, and monetize it. That's our IoT. 8. Men made it. The relentless drumbeat of inevitabilist messages presents the new apparatus of ubiquity as the product of technological forces that operate beyond human agency and the choices of communities. An implacable movement that originates outside history and exerts a momentum that, in some vague way, drives toward the perfection of the species and the planet. The image of technology as an autonomous force with unavoidable actions and consequences has been employed across the centuries to erase the fingerprints of power and absolve it of responsibility. The monster did it, not Victor Frankenstein. However, the ankle bracelet does not monitor the prisoner. The criminal justice system does that. Every doctrine of inevitability carries a weaponized virus of moral nihilism programmed to target human agency and delete resistance and creativity from the text of human possibility. Inevitability rhetoric is a cunning fraud designed to render us helpless and passive in the face of implacable forces that are and must always be indifferent to the merely human. This is the world of the robotized interface, where technologies work their will, resolutely protecting power from challenge. No one has expressed this with more insight and economy than John Steinbeck in the opening chapters of his masterwork, The Grapes of Wrath, which describes the Dust Bowl farmers who are thrown out of their Oklahoma homes during the Great Depression and then head west to California. The families are forced off the land that they have tended for generations. They plaintively argue their case to the bank agents sent to impress upon them the facts of their helplessness. But the agents respond with, "The bank is something else than men." It happens that every man in a bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. The bank is something more than men, I tell you. It's the monster. Men made it, but they can't control it. This theme of supposed technological autonomy is a venerable one among technology scholars. Langdon Winner again proves to be a worthy guide when he reminds us that an unquestioning acceptance of technology has become a feature of modern life. The changes and disruptions that an evolving technology repeatedly caused in modern life were accepted as given or inevitable simply because no one bothered to ask whether there were other possibilities. Winner observes that we have allowed ourselves to become committed to a pattern of technological drift, defined as accumulated unanticipated consequences. We accept the idea that technology must not be impeded if society is to prosper, and in this way we surrender to technological determinism. Rational consideration of social values is considered retrograde, Winner writes, not the ticket that scientific technology gives to civilization. To this day, any suggestions that the forward flow of technological innovation be in any way limited violate a fundamental taboo. Instead, we accept the change, later looking back upon what we have done to ourselves as a topic of curiosity. To Winner's curiosity, I add another theme, remorse. Surveillance capitalist leaders assume that we will succumb to the naturalistic fallacy, as Steinbeck's farmers were meant to do. Because Google is successful, because surveillance capitalism is successful, its rules must obviously be right and good. Like the bank agents, Google wants us to accept that its rules simply reflect the requirements of autonomous processes, something that people cannot control. However, our grasp of the inner logic of surveillance capitalism suggests otherwise. Men and women made it, and they can control it. They merely choose not to do so. Inevitabilism enshrines the apparatus of ubiquity as progress, but conceals the realpolitik of surveillance capitalism at work behind the scenes. We know that there can be alternative paths to a robust information capitalism that produces genuine solutions for a third modernity. We have seen that surveillance capitalism was discovered and honed in history, handcrafted by men and women to serve the interests of impatient capital. It is this same logic that now demands ubiquity, ready to colonize technical developments for the sake of its imperatives and growth. Inevitabilism operates in the service of these imperatives as it distracts attention from the ambitions of a rising economic order and the competitive anxieties that drive the surveillance project towards certainty, thus necessitating its ever more voracious claims on our behavior. Inevitabilism precludes choice and voluntary participation. It leaves no room for human will as the author of the future. This raises questions. At what point does inevitabilism's claim to ubiquitous extraction and execution shade into abuse? Will inevitabilism's utopian declarations summon new forms of coercion designed to quiet restless populations unable to quell their hankering for a future of their choice? 9. To the Ground Campaign. Google's declarations, surveillance capitalism's dominance over the division of learning in society and its laws of motion, ubiquitous architectures of extraction and execution, McKay's penetration of inaccessible regions while observing unrestrained animals with methods that elude their awareness, the uncontract and its displacement of society, Paradiso's ubiquitous sensate environment, dark data, the inevitabilism evangelists. There is one place where all these elements come together and transform a shared public space built for human engagement into a petri dish for the reality business of surveillance capitalism. That place is the city. Cisco has 120 smart cities globally, some of which have embraced Cisco Kinetic, which, as Jahangir Mohammed, the company's vice president and general manager of IoT, explains in a blog post, is a cloud-based platform that helps customers extract, compute, and move data from connected things to IoT applications to deliver better outcomes. Cisco Kinetic gets the right data to the right applications at the right time, while executing policies to enforce data ownership, privacy, security, and even data sovereignty laws. But, as is so often the case, the most audacious effort to transform the urban commons into the surveillance capitalist's equivalent of Paradiso's 250-acre marsh comes from Google, which has introduced and legitimated the concept of the for-profit city. Just as McKay had counseled and Weiser proselytized, the computer would be operational everywhere and detectable nowhere, always beyond the edge of individual awareness. In 2015, shortly after Google reorganized itself into a holding company called Alphabet, Sidewalk Labs became one of 9 confirmed companies under the Alphabet corporate umbrella. Whether what even Sidewalk CEO Dan Doktoroff, a former private equity financier, CEO of Bloomberg and deputy mayor of New York City in the Bloomberg administration, refers to as a Google city succeeds, the company has interested the public by recasting our central gathering place as a commercial operation in which once public assets and functions are reborn as the cornered raw materials earmarked for a new marketplace. In this vision, McKay and Paradiso's conceptions come to fruition under the auspices of surveillance capitalism in a grand scheme of vertically integrated supply, production, and sales. Sidewalk Labs' first public undertaking was the installation of several hundred free, internet-enabled kiosks in New York City, ostensibly to combat the problem of digital inequality. As we saw with Google Street View, the company can siphon a lot of valuable information about people from a Wi-Fi network, even if they don't use the kiosks. Doktoroff has characterized the Sidewalk Labs kiosks as fountains of data that will be equipped with environmental sensors and also collect other data, all of which can create very hyper-local information about conditions in the city. In 2016, the U.S. Department of Transportation, DOT, announced a partnership with Sidewalk Labs to funnel transit data to city officials. The DOT worked to draw cities into Google's orbit with a competition for $40 million in grants. Winners would work with Sidewalk Labs to integrate technology into municipal operations. But Sidewalk Labs was eager to work with finalists in order to develop its own traffic management system, Flow. Flow relies on Google Maps, Street View vehicles, and machine intelligence to capture and analyze data from drivers and public spaces. These analyses produce prediction products described as inferences about where people are coming from or going, enabling administrators to run virtual experiments and improve traffic flow. Doktoroff postulates a city presided over by digital omniscience. We're taking everything from anonymized smartphone data from billions of miles, trips, sensor data, and bringing that into a platform. Sidewalk refers to its high-tech services as new superpowers to extend access and mobility. Algorithms designed to maintain critical behaviors within a prescribed zone of action would manage these data flows. In a world in which we can monitor things like noise or vibrations, why do we need to have these very prescriptive building codes? As an alternative, Doktoroff suggests performance-based zoning administered by the ubiquitous apparatus through the medium of algorithms. These processes, like Varian's vehicular monitoring systems, are indifferent to why you behave, as long as they can monitor and control the behavior you produce. As Doktoroff explains it, I don't care what you put here, as long as you don't exceed performance standards like noise levels. This is preferable, he says, because it enhances the free flow of property that is a logical extension of these technologies. Why should citizens have any say over their communities and the long-term implications of how luxury high-rises, hotels, or a residential building going commercial could affect rents and local businesses as long as an algorithm is satisfied with noise thresholds? When Columbus, Ohio was named winner of the DOT competition, it began a 3-year demonstration project with Sidewalk, including 100 kiosks and free access to the Flow software. Documents and correspondence from this collaboration, eventually obtained by The Guardian, described innovations such as dynamic parking, optimized parking enforcement, and a shared mobility marketplace that reveal a more troubling pattern than the rhetoric suggests. Sidewalk's data flows combine public and private assets for sale in dynamic, real-time virtual markets that extract maximum fees from citizens and leave municipal governments dependent upon Sidewalk's proprietary information. For example, Public and private parking spaces are combined in online markets and rented on demand, as the cost of parking varies in real time, substantially increasing parking income. Optimized parking enforcement depends on sidewalks' algorithms to calculate the most lucrative routes for parking cops, earning cities millions of extra dollars that they desperately need, but that arrive at the expense of their citizens. Cities are required to invest substantial public monies in sidewalks' technology platform, including channeling municipal funds earmarked for low-cost public bus service into mobility markets that rely on private ride-sharing companies such as Uber. The company insists that cities share public transport data with ride-sharing companies, allowing Uber to direct cars to overcrowded bus stops. The Flow transit system integrates information and payment for nearly every kind of transport into Google Maps, and cities are obligated to upgrade to Sidewalk's mobile payment system for all existing transit and parking services. Just as it requires public transit data, Sidewalk also insists that cities share all parking and ridership information with Sidewalk Labs in real time. When asked, Doctoroff has emphasized the novel blending of public functions and private gain, assuring his listeners on both counts that our mission is to use technology to change cities, to bring technology to solve big urban problems. We expect to make a lot of money from this. In April 2016, a curated group of leaders in tech, media, and finance met at the Yale Club in Manhattan to hear Sidewalk CEO Dan Doctoroff's talk, Google City, How the Tech Juggernaut is Reimagining Cities Faster Than You Realize. His remarks provide a candid assessment of the Google City as a market operation shaped by the prediction imperative. He could not have been more direct in articulating Sidewalk Labs' approach as a translation of Google's online world to the reality of city life. In effect, what we're doing is replicating the digital experience in physical space. So, ubiquitous connectivity, incredible computing power, including artificial intelligence and machine learning, the ability to display data, sensing, including cameras and location data, as well as other kinds of specialized sensors. We fund it all through a very novel advertising model. We can actually then target ads to people in proximity, and then, obviously, over time, track them through things like beacons and location services, as well as their browsing activity. Later that year, Sidewalk announced collaborations with 16 additional cities, noting that achieving scale would enable it to improve its Flow software products. Doctoroff referred to these collaborations as inevitable. The vast and varied ground campaign already underway turns the prediction imperative into concrete activity. In pursuit of economies of scope, a wave of novel machine processes are honed for extraction, rendering people and things as behavioral data. For the sake of economies of action, the apparatus learns to interrupt the flow of personal experience in order to influence, modify, and direct our behavior, guided by the plans and interests of self-authorizing commercial actors and the buzzing market cosmos in which they participate. In nearly every case, the agents of institutionalization present their novel practices as if they are one thing, when they are, in fact, something altogether different. The realpolitik of commercial surveillance operations is concealed offstage, while the chorus of actors singing and dancing under the spotlights holds our attention and sometimes even our enthusiasm. They sweat under the stage lights for the sake of one aim: that we fail to notice the answers, or, better yet, forget to ask the questions. Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? In light of these ambitions, it is not surprising that Doctoroff, like Page, prefers lawless space. Press reports confirmed that Alphabet Google was actively considering a proposal for a new city, and that more than 100 urban planners, researchers, technologists, building experts, economists, and consultants were involved in the project. The Wall Street Journal reported that although it was unclear how the company would fund the tens of billions of dollars necessary for such a large-scale undertaking, one key element is that Sidewalk would be seeking autonomy from many city regulations so it could build without constraints. In October 2017, Doctoroff appeared with Alphabet Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to reveal that Toronto would be the site of Sidewalk's planned development. Its intent is to develop the right mix of technology that it can then license to cities around the world. The genesis of the thinking for Sidewalk Labs came from Google's founders getting excited, thinking of all the things you could do if someone would just give us a city and put us in charge. Toronto's Globe and Mail reported Schmidt as saying, noting that he joked he knew there were good reasons that doesn't happen. Then, just as quickly, the paper related Schmidt's reaction when he first learned that Sidewalk, and by extension Alphabet, had secured this opportunity in Toronto. "Oh my God, we've been selected. Now it's our turn."